someone become a superstar in Nigeria, and the most important thing is doing a show in America. And I'm like, dude, you're running away from the fan base that made you a superstar. Make it make sense. Examples of like Davido, Rema, Wizkid, Burna Boy, Olamide, them, like, not everybody can be as successful as that. But if you build a certain fan base and grow with them, you are good for life, because
Asa Asika is one of the most influential talent managers on the continent, best known for shaping the career of Davido and helping export Nigerian music to the world stage.
Nigeria and Afrobeats is a single-based market. All this album thing is really because of the contracts artists are signing and because they want to be nominated for the Grammy Best Global Album. That's really its best. There are some album artists in our market, but majority of our market is still a single-based market. We consume music very fast.
As co-founder of The Plug, he's managed artists, produced festivals, brokered global brand deals, and pioneered what it means to be a modern-day music executive in Africa.
When we opened up, the whole thing was like 8K first, and we got to 12K. I remember the promoters and our agent, everybody were like, I think we should stop it here. And we were like, why? I remember when we were arguing that we can do this, and people were like, don't think you can. So getting to that stage where like, we hit 14K tickets, hit 16K tickets. The challenges and people not believing in you and thinking that you can't do this.
In today's episode, we pull back the curtain on what it really takes to stay relevant in a rapidly evolving industry.
What sort of advice do you find yourself constantly giving to the ones up and coming?
My biggest piece of advice is always things like...
Asa.
What's up?
You have been in the game since you were a teenager.
Yeah.
And looking, it's been about, 15, 20 years now. So if you were to look back at your 16-year-old self who was hustling, even during the Storm Records time, how do you feel? Did you ever think you would be here?
16, that's 2009. Okay. Definitely not. I didn't think... Anybody who works in our space who would say to you that they thought they would be where we are today, I wouldn't say they're a liar, but they probably didn't think it would have gotten to this magnitude or us gotten into the rooms we've gotten into. So definitely not. Obviously, proud of what we've achieved as a movement, proud of what I've achieved personally, but obviously there's always room to grow. Like every time we're like, oh, I want to do this, you do it, and then, okay, what's next? So yeah.
And, you know, you have an incredible eye for talent, right? I mean, I think one of the things I admire about you is you're able to see someone's talent even when other people's cannot. So you started managing David O when he was just a guy with big dreams. Mm. You signed CK before the world knew him. What exactly did you see or sense an artist that tells you this person is special and worth your time?
Key thing being worth your time. Because obviously that. I feel like there are a million talented people in the world. Like everyone has some elements of talents, and it's just it's many factors. Like, you know, the saying like hard work, beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. Mm-hmm. That's the scenario most people need to live by when it comes to music. I get approached to work with talent all the time, but for me, sometimes it's a few factors. First factor is like, I genuinely actually need to mess with the music and the person's brand and just person as a human being, because with the way I work, we tend to like become very intertwined. So I'm not waking up and putting all my life into someone who I don't have a level of like, what's the word I would use? Affinity to. With example, with David, like David and I knew each other before music. We weren't the best of friends, but we were cordial. I knew he made music. He knew I worked in the music space on my uncle's label and stuff. And we had a few conversations, and he was someone who was confident in his dreams. Even before we got to like, okay, talking about music and stuff. I think that's like the first important stage. The period where I worked with CK, for example, like I knew CK was a step away from becoming a global superstar. Like he already put in so much work. It was just like, yo, there's a next level is coming. We just need to do a few things. Even with like with IOJ, for example, I remember bringing Ayo to Nigeria for the first time and everybody was like, oh, songs are all right. And then we go back to New York and the song's popping on radio and everyone's like, oh my God, he's Nigerian. And I'm like, I played this song to you guys a year ago. And obviously everyone's trajectory is different, how they blow up, how they do things. Some people like, for example, like with Davido, like from the first single, it's always just been a rise. There have been people who have had to put out 5-6 singles, and everyone always forgets that like the first single to the public, it's not never really everyone's first single. They've probably been in the studio and made 50 songs before that breakout. There's no overnight success story in any scenario. It's never happened. Like someone wakes up and boom, the first song they ever record. Like there has been some level of investment, even if it's not recording in a proper studio or mixing and mastering a song, you've probably made a song before. You've probably like made some leeway in the music business here or there. So for me, it's just connecting on multiple levels is the most important thing for me. Music obviously is a big important part, but we need to have some level of connection. If not, like, I'm not good at pretending. So by week two, you know that, yo, this guy doesn't really send me. So, and I've done that before. And from experience, I'm just like, I'm never doing that again. No matter how much anyone is hounding me or how much I'm being offered to be paid. I'm just like, I don't connect with it. That's just the way I approach things.
Yeah. And I even want to go deeper with CK because specifically he was obviously doing the work before his TikTok song that just went viral. How was that engineered? Like, how did that happen? Walk us through that process.
You know how you just have to be prepared for scenarios.
Yes.
Before like the whole song going off on TikTok, I was the most unfamiliar guy with TikTok personally. But I always say it, CK had a guy on his team called Favor, who was his day-to-day manager, who he was basically the one who taught me TikTok and stuff. The sound, I think the DJ is from Mauritius or somewhere. He did like a remix to it and we just realized that that sound started moving and going viral and we were basically just catching up on what was going on. It wasn't like, oh, this was engineered. You know, a lot of times it's something happens organically and you just have to run with it. And that was pretty much the scenario. We got ready as we saw what was happening and took advantage of it.
Asus, the plug isn't just a management outfit. Yeah. It's become an institution in Afrobeats. When you are thinking about legacy, what does that tangibly mean for you?
Probably just how we impact behind the scenes and obviously in front of the camera and stuff like that. Obviously, you can't tell certain stories without involving us in it. But also for me, like impact is like putting people on.
Yeah.
I'm not an artist. I'm more interested in like creating like the next bunch of talent managers or road managers or for example, people always, I think because, obviously the talent side of things is a side that's on social media on camera. Obviously we do so many other things. So even if from my event side, because for example, I really started working in entertainment through doing events. And obviously one of the things we've been able to do is create an event. One of our biggest events is Mainland Block Party. And Mainland Block Party is an event that creates a lot of jobs. Some of these jobs are, on a contract basis where we just hire people when we have events. Obviously we have a block party every month, so they know they have a job every month. They're the people who are actually on our team who run the events. And for me, it's a thing of being able to, cause I like to delegate, but I don't delegate easily. So it's the kind of thing I need to have a certain level of trust with people. And over the years, we've been able to get certain people on our team to grow to a certain level where, for example, I tell people all the time, there's certain places or certain things that are being done that I go to block party like 2 times a year. I don't think I've been to block party this year. We did a block party the other day. My business partner, Toby, who is the brainchild of the block party, is running that. If Toby calls me and says, oh, we need this, we need that, I will do my part. For example, one of the performers on the last block party was Mehdi. So because I was like, yo, I want to book Mehdi for this thing. This is the concept we have. No problem. Yo, bro, how far are you free on this day? Let's talk business. Let's do the numbers. Agreed. Oh, yeah, Toby, this is number. Close with him. That's my part. That's why it's a partnership. And the things I learn from my business partners, talk less of going out into the world. And these are the things that I want to be able to impact onto other people so they don't make some of the mistakes we made. I say to people all the time, because, for example, and I say all the time with David, for example, with David's first Sony contract, David was the guinea pig of Afrobeats. We made all the mistakes so other people don't. Like, if people are making the same mistakes we made in 2016, 2017, not only because the thing is, with Afrobeats, everybody's always trying to be the sharper guy. If the people that I speak to, and I say all the time, people like Muiwa, Donawan, Sam Frank, Anthony, those are like my three, like, younger manager guys. We speak every week. And I say this all the time. I gave you guys the example about the TikTok thing. I'm not afraid to learn from the youngest person in the room, the most inexperienced person in the room. That's one thing we as Africans and custodians of this movement need to learn. Mm. It's not always about who did it first. It's not always about I'm doing this or not doing this. It's about, okay, how can we do this one time and make sure it happens 20 times after? Mm-hmm. Because what happens a lot of times is 2-3 guys do something. If we're being real, this whole Afrobeats to the world thing, it's literally like 5 to 7, 8 artists that have really Afrobeats to the world. You have a popping song, it's playing on radio abroad, you do some shows here and there. That is 20% of the Afrobeats to the world.
Yeah.
They're still going to walk in Times Square and no one knows who you are. There are very few artists who have attained that level of success. But obviously, we've created this facade that, wow, Afrobeats is this, Afrobeats is that. Is it growing? Yes. Has there been a decline in certain parts of Afrobeats? Yes. And these are all things that we can fix because they're not issues that like are literally like entrenched in everything yet. It's so about, okay, we did this, we did that. This didn't work. Sharing knowledge, having conversations. So for me, it's a thing where like, I always try the best of the knowledge I have. Like, oh, I did this in the past, so it didn't work. What do you guys think? Asking questions, sharing knowledge. That's what I care about. I don't really care about my name being written in any book or me. I don't really care about stuff like that. Mine is the guys who know, and that's more than enough for me.
Yeah. Let's dive deeper into the origin of the plug, right? And I want you to speak also more to the importance of partnership, right? Because a lot of folks who are starting businesses don't always think through teamwork, right? They think, okay, I come through, I'm solo, I can start something and just run it till it becomes successful. Can you walk us through the origin of the plug and also the importance of the partnership between you, Toby, and Bizzle?
So the way the plug came about, so we used to do this thing. It was me, Bizzle, DJ Obi. Every summer from like July into August, we'd go to New York and just network, get Obi gigs here and there. I think we did it like 2-3 summers. Obviously, summer 16, everybody in that age knows summer 16 was the summer.
Yeah.
So we used to go to the Rock Nation office to work out of it, like Beehive and Brian Biggs, one of our mentors. So we used to go into his office a lot and do stuff. At this point in time, there wasn't anything called The Plug. Me and Bizzle just used to do a lot of things together. And one day, Bihai goes, why don't you guys just form a company called The Plug and merge your companies? You guys do everything together. So, and we were like, that actually makes a lot of sense. And obviously, it's nine in August. And don't get it twisted. Partnerships are one of the most complicated things. But when you get it right and you're able to, because the thing is, you have to understand that you are dealing with another human being. It's kind of like a relationship. So it was Bizzle and I, 2016. Obviously, Toby came in as a third partner later on. And it has its bumpy times. I spoke with Bizzle today on the way here. And it wasn't even a thing of, it's coming from a bad place. I'm like, why is this happening? Why are we not doing it like this? Okay, we've addressed, there's an issue. How are we fixing the issue? Oh, I don't think what you said makes sense because of this. Like, and you always have to have those kind of conversations. Like a partnership where you guys are deceiving yourselves and doing plaster on wounds. one day, everybody's going to be like, yo, this isn't going to work. Yeah. And boom. So I think partnerships are important because, perfect example, over the years, I think I have improved in terms of being a people's person. I don't think I was the most social person in the world. And that used to rub off on people in a certain way. And not because of me being proud or me being thinking I'm better than anybody, but on, what's the word to use? In hindsight, considering the kind of job I do, I'm actually an introvert. I will happily be in my house doing nothing for 2 weeks. COVID was an amazing time to me. I loved COVID.
What did you do during COVID?
Listen to music, hang out with family members. I hadn't played PlayStation like PlayStation in years. Ed drove my sister to Quacktails to pick up Quacktails, join Instagram lives. That was heaven to me because I've, from the age of like 20, I've literally spent at least 30% of my time in a year traveling and flying. So I loved it. This period we're in now is the longest I've been in Nigeria without leaving ages. I'm loving it. I'm like, wow, I'm actually enjoying my house because I like my home, so I would love to be in it. So I say that to say, Bizzle came to me, I was like, you know, this thing that you do, some people don't know you like that, and it rubs off. And I was like, okay, you know what? For you to say this thing to me like 3-4 times, clearly it's an issue. And I've made more of an effort to be like, hello, shake people, have brief conversations. And I've seen the change because I won't say his name, but there's a guy who I actually do a lot of business with. He's my friend who said to me, I was like, yo, I didn't like you just because the first time we met or the way you shook me. And I wasn't doing it because I thought he was less than me or I didn't give a damn about him. It's just the way I was. And obviously everybody has different ways they're brought up and stuff like that. Many things people do. I'm like, bro, I'm not going to do that. But obviously finding a middle ground. So for me, being able to have that kind of conversation on my business by saying, yo, I think you need to do this. Like I said to you before we came in here, me and Bezos have had so many arguments about different things. Cause I'll be like, okay, this thing that you did, I don't think it makes sense because it did this. Same way I'll have an argument with Toby or Toby and Bezos will be arguing. And I love the fact that like it's a triangle. So it's never like me versus you. It's always like, okay, there's a middle person in the middle. Like, yeah, what do you think? Or two of us saying this is what we should do. And one person saying, oh, but, and so it's a system that is like, okay, majority. And we have this thing where it's like, okay, if two people think this makes sense, we go about it that way.
Yeah.
If it goes wrong, we come back and say, okay, maybe you are right and the two of us were wrong. But being able to have those conversations is very, I think that's the most important thing in partnerships. And then also being able to define roles. Like you said in the beginning of the thing, our company has different layers to the different things we do. We're a brand agency. At the same time, we're also an experiential agency for some other brands. We do music distribution. We run events. We do talent management. So it's one of those things where I tell people all the time, I know a bit of everything, but this is not my strong point. You should be speaking to Toby. Or when it comes to like artist development, I use the example of Oxlade all the time. When Bizu was like, oh, there's this artist called Oxlade. Okay. And I was like, okay, cool. His music's cool, but I don't have the time to be sitting down with someone and trying to cultivate a sound and all these things. Literally the day Bezos goes to me, the Oxygen EP, I'll never forget. It was the day before COVID actually like really hit the world. Bezos sent me a link to the Oxygen EP. I think it was 5 or 6 songs. Said, listen to this. I just did it and I was like, okay, this is mad. This is the final product. Now I step in. I will do the marketing. I'll make sure people hear this song. And I wish that example of a successful partnership, everybody playing their roles and getting to a certain place. And we've been able to now do that. Obviously, everybody has their hits and misses, but it's just easier when everybody is doing the parts they're passionate about and they're the best at. For example, I don't think the only times I call Toby for block party stuff is, yo, I think we should book this artist, or, oh, this guy's going to be in Kenya. Why don't we just bring him here? Or Toby's calling me to say, oh, can you speak to this guy? I think we can do this for him. Or there's a business opportunity. I'm like, yo, this brand wants to get involved. I'm not sitting down in meetings to talk about what is happening in the day to day, but that is Toby's job.
Yeah.
The same way when we're closing, most of the brands that we represent in terms of agency work, I come into the first meeting and say, yo, we can do this. We can do this. This is how we'll do it. Boom, boom, boom. Deal signed. I've smiled. Bye bye. Toby, over to you. I've done my part. The same way we have an artist traveling or artist on road. I don't expect anybody to do that. That's me. Everyone knows that. And that is the power of partnerships. It also allows you to actually have a little bit of a life outside work, because in the past, one thing I've struggled with is like work-life balance. But as I've grown older, I've found out, nobody will tell you sleep is important, first of all. And then just making time to be sane. Sometimes people, like, for example, like last time me and you ran into each other at Mako. That night, I was out for one reason. The three guys you saw me with, we all went to secondary school together. I work with my best friend, Larry, who runs Plug Sports. Obviously, I speak to and see all the time. But my two other friends I was with, they don't work in the entertainment space. We don't have the opportunity to hang out as much as we want. I say to people all the time, there's one of those guys, if he doesn't see me face to face for a year, he checks in 10 times. And I'm like, no matter what, that's my guy. So obviously opportunity to go out as a group. I'm like, I'm tired though, but hell yeah, I want to hang out with my guys. Let's go. And to me, those are the things that are important to me. I'm not one of those guys that I want to be in the club with 25 artists that I'm pretending are my friends. I'm not that kind of guy. But I rather favor the 10, 15 actual relationships I have. Like, and I keep saying, for example, I'm not an artist. I don't need to be friends with artists. I'm doing business. I do have artists that are my friends, but being able to balance everything out, this is business. This is my friend. You're allowed to do business with your friends, but everybody being able to realize that, okay, no matter what's going on in our friendship right now, we have this thing to execute. Or I'm having an issue with you business-wise, it's not going to affect my friendship with you. vice versa. I think once all these things are done and other people being considered in them, you have, I won't say it's the best scenario, but it's an amazing scenario and you're setting yourself up for success. Yeah.
And I want to talk about this friendship thing, because a lot of people are struggling with it, right? And and for someone who is also, even though you're not an artist, you are in the limelight.
Yeah.
How do you manage and or able to discern people who are actually your friends?
I don't refer to people as my friends easily.
Mm.
Yeah. I'll say, oh, that's my guy. Oh, you are cool. But in terms of like friends, for me, I define friends as a few things. Why not swear on this podcast?
No, go ahead. I don't know why people think they care about this.
You know, you guys have a very formal.
I know you can.
So for me, it's like, when ish hits the fan, who are the guys that have been there? Who are the guys that you've been able to have awkward conversations with? Who are the guys that who have been able to like better you as a person? Who are the people that the reference I always make, and it involves two people, one business partner, one friend and business partner. He said something to me when he was like, when you are in the middle of doing nonsense, you never realize you are doing nonsense. The minute you remove yourself from that nonsense and you look back at it, you're going to be like, oh my God, I was doing nonsense. Obviously, at that point in time, it went over my head. But then when I removed myself from nonsense, I was like, wow, what you said actually made a lot of sense. Guy, I reach you for that. But next time, please help me and put me out of the nonsense, pastor. Things like that. Or little things where like, everybody wants to link up on Friday at Mekong and have drinks. But guy, we're all grown men here. We have bills to pay. We have families we're taking care of. How are we making money? How are we doing constructive stuff? Like I said, how are we bettering each other as people? It doesn't always have to be financially, but, and I say that to people all the time, a group of friends I have, I know why we are friends. I know the parameters of our friendship. There's certain things that, let's, for example, you would do to me that I would not take personal, but you would do to me that I would take personal because of the kind of friendship we have. And I think once that is, put in place, there are friends I have today that I've only been friends with them for 3 years, but I will rate them higher over certain people in my life just because of scenarios we've been in, conversations we've had. And I'm like, okay, this friend is a, we're going to club. Yeah, my guy. Yeah. Oh yeah, this guy, I have this business idea. Yeah, my guy. Guy, I'm in this scenario. What do you think? Like, I think having that, like, I don't think it's possible that one friend can solve all your problems.
Yeah.
They have their own problems too.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thank God that I've been able to do business with most of my friends with no issues. I don't think the people that I refer to as friends, most of them, whether are in business now or have done business in the past, and we don't have any issues. Like, okay, let me use like DJ Obi for an example. I managed Obi for 4 or 5 years. Obi was the first actual official client on the plug. Obi and I owned a lounge with another friend of ours for ages. As of today, me and him actually don't have any existing business. We're still friends.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things where the business has scattered now. Yeah. And that's the thing about it. Like, while operating these businesses, we're still operating them as friends. If I did that to you, would you like it? If you did that to me, going back to all the stuff of being considerate.
Yeah.
So, and I always a perfect example, whether if our business is going well or not, or we're having issues, if we're friends, we're still friends. Like I said before, like my best friend of almost 14, 15 years, Larry Bago, runs Plug Sports.
Yeah.
We obviously have difficult conversations here and there. Larry, for example, is the easiest. Larry is an angel. He's not a confrontational guy. I am the confrontational guy. So when we have to have some awkward conversations, even him sometimes, I know he wants to say certain things to me, but he's just not that kind of guy.
Yeah.
So I'm the one that sometimes has to take it and be like, but this thing, that's, if your friendship is not built on a certain level of understanding and
accountability
and values, can break some friendships. Cause I can be like, no, this morning you have to do this, or no, we're doing this on this. Some people will take that pee and it's, before you know it now, the ripple effect of that is the friendship is over.
Yeah.
I think that's also why I'm picky about who, the same thing I was saying about like clients, I'm picky about who I do business with, because I've been burnt in the past and I like to use my experiences to teach me that I don't want to have this issue again. Yeah. I don't like, and that's my thing. Anybody who knows me is, I have a select group of friends and I have certain family members that are my people. Everybody knows that. For example, if you see me at Mako, the probability of seeing Nito there is high because those are my people I trust. That's my circle, and I'm happy with it. Things like that. And those are my values. Everybody has their own values, but me, I like peace. And I will forever be a man of peace.
So speaking about, you talked about work-life balance, you know, you are on the road a lot, yeah. Right? I think you're about to go on tour soon, right? Right? Yeah. So can you take me back to one night? Tell us a story of when being on the road, it tested you physically and emotionally. Maybe something went wrong. Maybe something didn't go according to plan, or maybe you were just tired.
Trying to think of, okay, let's use, was it 2020, I think last year, early 2024, we did, or was it 2023? I'm not sure what year it was. We did the O2 Arena and we did the Accor Arena in Paris, like back to back. Obviously, production backlines, the production from London, our production team is driving to Paris. There are always the probabilities of stuff being delayed. Stuff gets to Paris, but it doesn't get there on time. Obviously, I say to people all the time, one of the hardest markets to do things in to me is France, because culturally, everybody's just different. There's a language barrier, different things. Long story short, we get equipment into the venue late and we're running behind schedule. Setup time, me and David's a sound check. I want the opening acts to sound check. It just doesn't go according to plan. And obviously, I have to go and have a conversation with D and be like, yo, you're probably going to get 5 minutes before to sound check. We're going to have to rough this one because these guys have been very insistent about doors opening at a certain time. And I'm like, I really don't want to get into it with them because it could go left. So, and I remember that day I had a really, really, really bad headache. So I'm in the venue trying to sort all these issues out and my head is pounding. So for me, it's just like, yo, can we just get this sorted so I can just go into the dressing room for like 45 minutes to just sleep. I'll just like put my brain off for a second. Even when we were doing the run for five, when we did the five underplays, I think when we got back to Atlanta, Atlanta was the last underplay we did in the States. Obviously, Atlanta is home. We're playing it. Obviously, these shows are really tiny shows. We're playing a little venue in Midtown. My house is like 10 minutes down the road. That day, I hadn't been sleeping a lot because obviously it's just before the album comes out, making sure clearances are in, everything's uploaded properly. But obviously the show must go on. So on the way to the venue, I told the driver, I'm like, yo, can we stop by CVS? I need to get some sort of medicine. I have a really bad headache. But in this scenario, I know it's because I've not been sleeping. Go in, get some meds, take them. Luckily for me, my actual, like, the best doctor I've ever been exposed to in my life, who I've ever dealt with in Nigeria, moved to Atlanta. So randomly, whenever I have like random issues, I'm just like, yo, I beg, this is what's going on. So I call her. I'm like, I have a really bad headache. And her first thing is always, because we connected at a time where I wasn't sleeping a lot and it was really messing with my health. So the first question she always asks me is like, have you been sleeping? And I'll be like, in this scenario, yes, I haven't been sleeping as much as I should have been sleeping, but this is why. This is the last show. I'm not going to an after party. I'm going straight home. Tells me, take this. I promise that you tomorrow, I'm coming to see you. Take the meds, get into the venue. Obviously, sound check. Music is playing mad loud. It's a small venue where like a tiny slim wall is between the green room and the stage. So even lying down in the green room is kind of pointless. I make sure everything's good. Go into the room, fall asleep. I think I wake up when like David's DJ gets there or something. And he's like, I'm like, bro, I have a mad headache. I beg, let's just do this thing and go. The minute the show is over, I'm like, I do it all the time normally, unless I'm actually going to the after party. Once the show is over, I'm gone. And I'm like, guys, I don't feel well. I'm going home, go and sleep. Those are two scenarios that come to head where it's like a little bit of, like, obviously the Atlanta one was just health. The Paris one was health and logistics. But I can give you stories and stories. I can give you way worse ones than this one. These are like the PG ones.
A lot of people think management is just on the professional side of things, but it's also almost acting as a therapist, right? Like you go into a room, you also have to be able to regulate the emotion, not just of the artist that you're talent, but also of everybody else on the team. Can you walk us through what that looks like on an everyday basis? And especially how do you do self-care after?
I think scenarios are different here because different talents, different things. Using like, for example, like David as an example, isn't a good scenario because apart from him being like my business partner, like he's actually my friend. He's my brother. So I'm able to have conversations with him that I would not have with necessarily every client. And the good thing about like that setup is that we've all grown up together. So if, for example, me and Tycoon are having a fight, David can be the mediator because he knows the kind of guys we are. Or if me and Latia are having an argument or Latia and Tycoon are having an argument, it's not going to last long because we've been around each other for so long that we know how we all are. And we have a WhatsApp group where we have thrashed all sorts of issues out over. I always tell people all the time, I say that WhatsApp group, because that WhatsApp group has existed since 2017. I say to people like, if that WhatsApp group ever leaks, I don't know what will happen. But we've had all sorts of conversations, good, bad, funny, sad. Obviously, that's an ideal scenario, but that is not always the scenario. Obviously, people look at it as, oh, management. And there have been times when David has been my therapist. There have been times when I've been his therapist. Or Equal has been my that's like an amazing setup, but it's not always the scenario. But for me, the most important thing is being able to carve out some me time no matter what. So for example, I have my phone set up where I think it's 10:30. They go on DND no matter what. And certain people are favorites on it. So for example, family members, my wife, David, my business partners. But no Tom, Dick and Harry is calling me at that time and I'm picking up unless it's something that important.
Yeah.
I think being able to carve out that work-life balance is so important. And it even goes to things like how I say to people, like I make out time for my friends, my family, no matter what, even if it's little Aniki will tell you this about me. Even if it's a scenario where I can swing by their house for 30 minutes to play with their kids, I will do it just because the kind of person I am, I also enjoy. I would rather be hanging out with them than be hanging out with four niggas.
Sorry. No, go ahead.
Four guys that I don't really care about in a club. That's just me. I do enjoy going to clubs, but not every weekend or not every day.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. There was no blueprint for this. Like when we were starting out at Storm Records, Storm Records was a record label, but it wasn't at the level the plug was. Can you teach us or talk to us through some of the learnings you learned through that period working at Storm Records, dealing with artists that have served you till today?
I would say maybe the biggest thing I learned was the whole being selfless. Like it's never I or me, it's us, we. That's one thing I can tell you that I learned from Uncle Obi. It's always about, if this person isn't A1, we aren't A1 because you're as weak as the weakest person on your team. I think another thing that was very important then is a lot of DJs will tell you this about me. Like, till today, as big as David is, connecting with DJs is very important to me. Mm-hmm. I speak to a lot of DJs one-on-one. I make sure DJs get service music properly. Like, I'm not sending you a WhatsApp file. I'm not sending you a 500 megabytes file on WhatsApp. I'm sending like a proper DJ pack. You're getting before the song is out.
Yeah.
I'm letting you feel involved in the process. I'm letting you know that we actually value and respect you, because obviously with the way music has grown and with trends coming here and there, there are always going to be those seasons when certain things are quote unquote not as in vogue, but they're always going to come back.
Yeah.
Fashion is a perfect example. It's how, for example, record labels will say, oh, we're not going to spend $50,000 on a music video anymore because we can put that money on TikTok and make a hit.
Yeah.
All these things are going to come and go. I was having a conversation with someone on YouTube the other day. YouTube is still growing. Like, I think YouTube in 2024 had, was it 4 billion or 40 billion views on the platform before September was done for the year.
Crazy.
So, because something is in vogue right now does not mean you have to forget about where you're coming from or like the general like basics that are standard in this thing. I think those things are very, very important. And that's one thing I know I definitely learned, because I came up in Storm as being the guy who used to go to the club to make sure the DJs were playing the songs.
Yeah.
So I've done that on the lowest level and I've done it on the highest level. And I don't think whether you're messing with an A-list artist or a Z-list artist, it should change. I remember when we were trying to push your number in Nigeria before we went back to the US to push it, DJ Spinner was one of the DJs who played that record the most. Spinner liked the record. Obviously, he had met Ayo in New York. I linked them. We'd had some conversations. But it was also a thing of leveraging the fact that we had an amazing relationship. I don't think, off the top of my head, I might be wrong, there might be other DJs, but a DJ that stands out for me at that point in time that supported that record was Spindle. And it was a thing of relationships. Like, I made sure and I enforced, and it's something I also did with David when David was coming up. I made sure that David had his own relationships with DJs, because that personal touch can never be defeated. It's nice when, like, oh, there's an artist manager who is also friends with these guys. And bear in mind, for me, it's also the ecosystem of the fact that we've built things at the plug. I'm giving these DJs gigs. I'm putting money in their pockets. I'm creating opportunities for them. So at the same time, when I'm saying to you, please, can you play this song, or please, can you support this record? It's not a parasitic relationship. It's symbiotic. We're both helping each other. That's where things like us owning Hotbox, or us owning the Block Party, or us being a talent agency for Martell or Jameson comes into play. Because it's like, yo, no matter what, this guy's going to give me 5 gigs this year.
Yeah.
I'm of more value to you. I'm of more value to you than a typical artist manager, because of the fact that I'm not just coming to you every day before to play this guy's song. So it all comes together.
You have an ecosystem. I think one of our favorite quotes is playing long-term games with long-term people, right? So,
you know what's funny?
Yeah.
It's something I used to say to, like, David and Cyclone. I'm like, Baba, leave all these people. Also, we're here for the long run. Don't be thinking about this facade, or these facades that are created here and there to last 2 weeks, or to get a social media trend on. We've been doing this now for 1 year, 14.
If we had
chased certain trends at the level of artist you are, it would be detrimental to your career. So just because something is cool in 2013 or 2023, doesn't necessarily mean you have to follow that trend. Every artist's story is different. Everybody's trajectory is different. So eyes on the prize, no matter what.
One other question I have is the dichotomy between data analytics and instincts, right? Afrobeats now has a lot of data analytics that are involved in it. But when we're all coming up, we all went off a feeling, right? We all went off of the instinct, the ancestral drums, all of that. How do you balance that, especially now that international records going up, you're probably meeting people who might not be from the same sort of scenarios that we're from, and you're having to balance between instinct, intuition versus data and analytics. How does that work?
It's something I'm very vocal about. Any label I've worked with will tell you. So for example, let's use, we have a single coming out. We've gotten all UK DJs or all French DJs to play this record. What is the proof they're playing the record? I'm not going to believe a sheet of paper. I tell people all the time, because of the fact that I am so associated with Davido, if a song is doing well, I will get tweeted about it. If a show is being promoted well, I will be able to tell from my mentions on Twitter. If a song is doing well in a certain market, as bad as it bad, I will have 5 mentions on my Twitter in a month, and I will know this is what is going on. So you sitting down and saying to me, oh, this song is going amazing well in the UK, I don't believe you, because why am I not getting mentions? Why have I not been sent in a video? I spent 30 to 40% of my time a year in London. I know DJs. I have friends who are in clubs. I know promoters. If my song is popping in the club, I don't need you to tell me. The analytics come into place, for example, with the way like radio works in other regions. And Nigeria is becoming like that, where radio is more systemized. So data now becomes
available,
available, and is more accurate to an extent. But then your record has to be on a certain level for this data to even make sense. If you're an up-and-coming artist who is just talking to Kemi Smalls at Cool FM, I'm an artist, please let me play, and she's playing it for you here or there, like, quote-unquote, like how in America we'll take your songs from, like, being on mixed show to this level, to this level. We're just getting to that system in Nigeria. So if your song is, as an up-and-coming artist, being played 6 times a day across maybe 20 radio stations, I don't need data for that now. When your song has been played 5 times a day on every radio station, and here you can sit back and say, okay, this one is playing it twice, this one is playing it 5. How can we turn 2 here on this one to this 5? Who are the people playing this song? Was it a DJ playing it while he was doing a mix? Or was it in the system? Or was it just freelance at this point of time? Then data makes sense. Obviously, with things like YouTube, data makes sense. Obviously, with things like Spotify and all these things. But all these things, you have to remember the balance of things. In America, data is cheap as hell. You can have a T-Mobile plan that gives you free Apple Music subscription. It doesn't work like that in Nigeria. In Nigeria, we've not been able to build a DSP that is tied into our networks. where if you're spending 5K credits a month, you know that I can stream everybody's music on that. Obviously, there have been attempts where Tidal tried to do the partnership with MTN. There's been obviously AudioMac, but obviously the business side of AudioMac has not been accepted or built properly for labels to accept it. So if you're going off of data, like data, there are artists who are huge on AudioMac. They'll do a show in Nigeria. They can pull 20,000 people. Mm. Those people cannot sell 1,000 tickets in London. Mm. So that's where the data now comes into place. Because you are a king in Colombia doesn't mean you are a king in Germany. Mm-hmm. Everybody's fan base is different. It's like saying, let me use an example. Let's put in quote unquote, like Jerick, the Igbo rapper, and Shay Vibes. It's like saying Jerick will do a show in Enugu for 15,000 people and come and replicate the same thing here. Or Shay Vibes is going to go to Enugu on Icha now. I don't see it happening. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if work is put in and things are promoted, you can get to it. But like, off the flip, it's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. For example, if you go on Apple, is it Apple or YouTube? There's a documentary where when Cuba, the America-Cuba border thing, Major mm-hmm. Lazer went to do a free show in Cuba. And the biggest like hurdle for them was like, how do you make sure these guys actually know our music?
Yeah.
Because at that point in time, the biggest ways of people getting music, it wasn't LimeWire, but it was something similar to LimeWire. These guys spent months promoting and pushing their music on that platform so that when they came to the country, guys would know their music. There's always obviously the superstar effect that, oh, this is Diplo, this is Major Lazer coming. People will come to the show, yeah. but will they hear the music?
Yeah.
Because remember, at the end of the day, even for us as, and I say to people all the time, when I book shows for David in particular, I'm going to sit back and look at like his YouTube stats. I'm going to go on Spotify for artists and be like, okay, one thing I know, for example, is when David performs in Caribbean countries, even if, for example, in his typical sets today, he's not performing Assurance, in the Caribbean, he does. Mm-hmm. Why is that a thing? Because first of all, the video was shot in Barbados. There's the affinity to that song just because it was shot there.
Yeah.
David can go to Barbados and close his shows with Assurance today because the local people like it because they're like, this guy shot this video here. This is our song.
Yeah.
The same way I'm going to go to Jamaica and make sure certain songs I might not perform in Nigeria, or if Risky is song 8 in Lagos, Risky is song 25 in Jamaica, just because of the fact that I'm understanding where I am. The same way if you look at the track list for 5, there are certain songs that if you have any element of sense or any element of like simple economics and supply and demand, you know why there are certain features. You know why, okay, for example, Loverboy, the song with Tyke and Daju, that is an obvious, I want this song to do well in Francophone Africa and France. Mm. And all these things are done off of data.
Yeah.
Loverboy was a song that was meant to be on Timeless. It was just Tyke on the song. The song didn't make Timeless for a certain reason. I was like, okay, let's put it on this next album. At that point in time, Tyke and Daju had done a whole tour together. Mm. They were doing their own Watch the Throne. And I was like, we have access to this guy. They've never done a feature together as them. Let's do it. And all these things are obviously intuition driven, data driven. Mm. I know. So for example, I don't need data to tell me that a Davido and Chris Brown song is going to do well. It has passed that stage.
Yeah. Yes.
But, and it's the same thing where I will say to a label, like, label will say, oh, if we get Davido in the studio with a song with maybe The Weeknd or Post Malone or Drake, on paper, it's going to be huge. And I say to people all the time, I'm like, bro, we've done these things before. The biggest Davido songs are the Davido solo songs or Afrobeat features where Davido brings people into his own world.
Yeah.
Don't get it twisted. We've done this thing many times. You guys have put budget behind this. Like, for example, there are many times where they'll say, oh, I think David gets on this feature will really help this and help that. I'm like, yeah, obviously it will, but it's not going to be what you think it's going to be.
Mm.
This is a man who has stood by his African heritage and built his brand in a certain way. So you now making him go and sing a pop song with some person, obviously will open up to a new market. But in terms of his core audience and core fan base buying into it, there's a disconnect.
Yeah.
Like I've witnessed that so many times with different artists with like, maybe we're releasing songs on a BPM of 90 BPM, 5-song success, and then boom, you drop a song at 120 something BPM. There's a disconnect because you built a fan base on a certain level. You can't just go, I'm going left, and then just jump right. Yeah. There is economics, certainly. That's where data comes in. but also it's a certain level of experience and common sense. Mm-hmm. It's how you're not going to see Johnny Drill fighting to be on a show that is built for rocks. Or how SDC have built Palm Wine Fest as their thing. They know a certain music, certain kind of music consumer is coming here.
Yeah.
I think it's always, it's amazing. The examples of like a Davido, a Rema, a Wizkid, a Burna Boy, Olamide, them, like not everybody can be as successful as that. But if you build a certain fan base and grow with them, you are good for life because they grow with you. Perfect examples of this, SDC, DRB, the alter scene, the other people, like, Thames is taking out of that alter scene because of how big she is now, but that's where she like started from. And obviously she's a once in a blue moon case. Not everyone is going to be as big or as successful as her. Not saying it's not possible, but that's normally how it happens. So it's just about using what you have, or it's how someone become a superstar in Nigeria. And the most important thing is doing a show in America. And I'm like, dude, you're running away from the fan base that made you a superstar. But you're not saying, oh, the most important thing to me, even before putting an album out now, is I want to be doing shows in New York and LA or Frankfurt. Make it make sense. You've not even connected with everybody who has actually contributed to making you a success. Obviously, there's the aspect of I want to make FX, but then sometimes you rush to things and you get it that one time and you never get it again because you've not, the foundation has not been built properly.
And actually, speaking of FX, that was my next question. So this is out of something I have quietly been observing, right? Which is, it starts to feel like Nigerian artists are being priced out of Nigeria, right? In the sense of like these concerts, like how are you able to balance that when an artist gets so big that when it comes time to December, Easter, certain periods, and a brand wants to pay them, like how are you able to reconcile that?
I think going back to what we just said about recognizing your core fan base, recognizing how you built your brand, and then also taking into consideration how you can connect with them and stay relevant with them, and then not being the disconnect of you feeling as if you abandoned the guys who made you a superstar. Because it's happened in the past where artists feel they're so big and then they do it. And that's the thing about it. Every artist's story is different. Some people can get away with doing one show in Nigeria a year. Some can't. I use David's brand as an example. David is a man of the people. Forget about the money. David is never going to be happy performing in Nigeria once a year. So being able to accommodate that is not taking into consideration the state of the economy in Nigeria. If, for example, I'm doing a show in Togo and MCN is the sponsor, and MCN can pay me $1 million for that show, I'm not now going to go and inflict that to a local promoter in Nigeria who does not have, okay, let me do an example now. I'll go and tell Cecil that, yo, for flight time this year, pay me $1 million. From, it's from a value side, as a human being, as a person understanding the business and where we built the business from, it doesn't sit right with me. We should never be too big to perform at home. Yes, you can create scenarios where you're not doing certain shows or not doing like these Christmas parties here and there, but you should have time to make sure that you're tapping with the important people. People say all the time now, like, oh, this Davido guy is doing radio and doing press like an up-and-coming artist. It's not that. I want to touch fan bases that have contributed to my success. Half of the interviews David is doing in America, they're asking the same question they're asking him 4 years ago.
I said this. I literally said this.
And it's not because we enjoy doing those things. It's because we're promoting music. Like, these interviews are not being done just to promote his music. I don't think there's any platform David has been on internationally where he has not gone out of his way to say, there's me, but there's 500 other me's where I'm coming from. Come to Nigeria at Christmas, experience this thing. People wake up and say, oh, Dirty December. Dirty December did not just appear. It has been a contribution and the adding and adding and adding of, oh, David's BT speech in 2018 is a contribution to that. People going to Ghana for Year of the Return is a contribution to that. People coming to go to Zaza or Boho or Hotbox or WY is a contribution to that. People did not just wake up one morning and say, oh, Africa is cool. I want to go to Africa. That's nothing. There are people who bought their tickets for Christmas to Nigeria already because of what they saw last Christmas.
Yeah. Yes.
Whether it's little things like Diplo coming here and playing Giddy Culture Fest or playing Mainland Block Party or Anasis coming here to do a camp or coming here to shoot a video. Mm. All this Lil Baby coming here to perform at BTFM. Bad and Bougie blew up as a record from Nigeria. Those videos of people going crazy to Bad and Bougie in Nigeria was part of what marketed that song to become a phenomenal hit.
Yes.
When J. Cole came to Nigeria, his project had just dropped 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago before.
That was crazy.
J. Cole was blown away that, yo, you guys have made it seem like these guys don't know what's going on in America. How do they know my records? All these things are the things that are bridging the gap. People coming here to shoot movies. Dylab having pop-ups in the US. Kai Collective being owned by a Nigerian and being able to do what they've done. All these things have contributed to what we now see.
Yeah.
We've basically built our own ecosystem with no support from the government or the bodies who are meant to be doing these things. And, okay, for example, remember when the value of the Naira went up a little bit before Christmas?
Yeah.
How did that happen? It wasn't because anybody was doing any magic. It's because people are coming to Nigeria. Mm-hmm. People are coming here, changing money, buying tickets, spending money in all these places. Yeah. There was a ripple effect.
Yeah.
And this wasn't just done because Davido said, come to Nigeria, or Burna Boy is from Nigeria, or Genevieve Nagy, this actress. It is a combination of so many years of doing all of these things. And it's a thing where while there's an interest and there's a winner to do these things, if we didn't take advantage of these things, we're going to be here in 5 years and be like, wow, do you remember that time when we had a song on the top 100 or we played Madison Square Garden? Mm-hmm. The next generation of people won't have the opportunity to do these things. Mm-hmm. So it's about building these structures and supporting each other, putting each other on, educating each other, not gatekeeping how you did this or did that. It makes no sense.
You know, you touched earlier and said the Sony deal, you guys were a guinea pig for the industry at the time, right? Can we also say, like, go back a little bit further and say maybe you've also been a guinea pig for management in the system? And what I want us to talk about is the period when you first started with David, split, and then came back later. What would you say you both have learned from that situation, but more specifically from you, your end? Because with the split, you obviously had to keep on going. When you guys came back, was there more a sense of maturity about the relationship now where you can now say, guy, we're doing this thing for life?
I think, I say to people all the time, the best thing that happened to both of us was that. Because when we started working together again, there was more of a mutual respect, number one. And there was also the fact that as much as you were doing your thing and attaining a certain level of success, I was also doing things and attaining a certain level of success on my own. So it's like, guy, I'm good without you, you're good without me, but together we're amazing.
Yeah.
That is a real partnership.
Yeah.
Understanding that this is what this person brings to the table. I think as an individual, it allowed me to step back and be like, okay, what have I done wrong? What do I need to work on as a person? What parameters do I need to set up, or what do I need to do differently to make me a better person to run this business like this? Stuff like that. I think those are the things. And like I was saying earlier on, it's about having these hard conversations and being able to, it's not easy to do, but once in a while, self-reflecting and saying, okay, this went wrong. Why did it go wrong? This went right. How do I continue to do this? Once we're able to do those kind of things continuously, by default, even if you want to lie to yourself, you always know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the most important thing in that whole scenario for me, was being able to take the experience from it and come back and be like, okay, we're doing it again and this is how we're going to do it. Mm-hmm. And these are the parameters we've set. These are the things that we're going to do differently. This is what I'm going to do. This is what you're going to do. And it just makes life much easier.
Can we talk about the year 2017? Yeah. As somebody who was doing events that year as a promoter in the US, I remember that year David came out with If, Fall, Fire, Fall.
Like that.
Like that. As a promoter, I remember just saying to myself, like, these people should space this thing out now. Like, we need to be able to keep selling tickets up until the year before. But what did that year feel like? Because it felt like David had come back and reconnected back to the roots. And, you know, it just was hit after hit after hit. Now, obviously, looking back, you know, there's an abundance. You don't have to move from scarcity. But what did it feel like? Just even the decisions to just, guys, we're going to finish them with all these hits back to back to back.
That year was a statement year.
Yeah.
2016 was an experimental year. And I was like, okay, what are we going to do? When I go and say an experimental year, it was not a great year in comparison to other years David had had. Some artists would have David 2016 and be happy. It would be the best year of their career. But for the level that we had built and set, it wasn't where we wanted to be. I go back to this whole guinea pig thing because obviously new system, these guys are learning about Afrobeats. Image and plan to create an Afrobeat superstar wasn't what was going to work.
Yeah.
And so today, as a conversation I have with international bodies involved in Afrobeats, whether it's being like creating the music, marketing the shows, many things. And so for us, it was a thing of, you know, some of those songs, like for example, If was an undeniable hit. If was, I think a week after If came out, we were doing a show in Minneapolis and I was like, Omo, this song is a problem. But we knew that we had another song that was going to be as big as it or even bigger.
Yeah.
Arguably, obviously internationally, Fall is a bigger song, but on the continent of Africa, If is a bigger song. Yeah. And these are good problems to have. We had those two records and what was our plan? Our next single was like that. We had shot the video in LA. At that point in time, that was the most expensive video I'd ever shot. And for us, we were like, yeah, we'll end the year with this song. Three-peat, amazing year. Even without putting out a third record, our year was done.
Yeah.
But it was like, let's put out one more just for Christmas. And obviously, Nigeria and Afrobeats is a single-based market. Mm. All these album thing is really because of the contracts artists are signing and because they want to be nominated for the Grammy Best Global Album. Mm. That's really its first.
Yeah.
There are some album artists among in our market, but majority of our market is still a single-based market. We consume music very fast. Mm. So when you're looking at it from a best like a business perspective, they're releasing 17 songs and people are going to choose one song.
Yeah.
You spent 18 months creating this project, spending all this money. Doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
We had prepared to release like that. I don't remember the time frame, but I know it was Q4. And then something happens. They record this song, Fire. And even Sony were like, we can't release this song because everything is set up for like that. But what happened was the leverage I had with Sony was that when I started working with David again, I said to them, this system you people are doing cannot work. And I'm going to show you. So I had the first conversation, loads of, but even putting out If was a bit of a struggle because the label were like, we just put out this, put the first record out. Obviously my chest is bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I can walk into the meeting and say, I told you.
Mm-hmm.
Put out 4. I'm able to walk in and say, I told you guys, this is how this thing is going to work. Yeah. I remember having to send emails, copying bare people across the whole Sony because bear in mind at that point in time, David was still an international artist signed to Sony. So there were many people in the port.
Mm-hmm.
So we needed to get, I think David himself even sent an email to the label that time saying, we need to release Fire now.
Mm.
But if we don't release this song now, we're going to lose the moment.
Yeah.
But the issue and the mistake the label made was they now refused to hold like that. They're like, oh, like that's still going to come out because we've pitched certain things and gotten certain support on the record.
Yeah.
So we'd still like to get that exposure. Obviously, like that is not on the same level as those three other songs.
Mm.
But we go anywhere and perform those songs, it still gets a reaction.
Yeah.
Like that is a record that is like a fan favorite with certain crowds. I remember we performed like that Christmas at Native Land. That is prime like that crowd. Mm. A show like Palm Wine Fest.
Mm.
Those are that like Otter crowd. Like that is like a staple Davido favorite. We don't need to go and do a show in Abeokuta and perform like that.
Mm.
Or go to like, let's say, University of Enugu is not really for those people.
Mm-hmm.
And, but remember at the same time, music is very universal. What I'm saying here might be wrong. And it obviously is Davido. The song will still be a big song, but it's not like a do or die. You must perform the song there. So unfortunately, the song came out. It did what it did, but Fire was so big that it literally just pushed like that to the side. That's why most people be like, oh, that Davido run. 343. Some people don't even acknowledge the fact that that song came out. That's my favorite song of those 4 songs.
Yeah.
But one thing I've learned over the years is my personal favorite songs are never necessarily the most commercial. Like I have a very like peculiar taste for music. Like if you go on my phone, like I listen to Afrobeats, but I'm also listening to country music. I'm also listening to EDM. I'm also listening to R&B. If somebody asked me to make a playlist of 15 songs I'm listening to now, it would be a bit of everything. Like, for example, my favorite artist last year was Jelly Roll. Jelly Roll is a country artist. Half of 75% of Nigeria don't even know who the guy is. So and that's one thing about experience with music. I'm not imposing my personal taste onto our song selection.
Yeah.
I'm never saying because I like this song, this is the next single. Even the system in which we choose music is never a thing of, obviously David as the artist has his vetoes here and there, but it's never a thing of, guy, I like this song, it must come. There are records we have that I know when they eventually come out will be huge, but timing is one thing with music, like we have learned from like that. And there's so many, like I always tell people, I'm like, if like that came out in 2025, I know what that song would do.
Yeah.
But you live and you learn.
Well, what does it look like knowing you're sitting on hits, right? And because music is about timing, people are not just releasing. I think we had World here and he says sometimes you can sit on a record for a year.
Okay.
What does that look like? Because sometimes it's like...
1 year is even small.
1 year is small, but what does that feel like as a person who's like, yo, you're walking around with gold that people don't see and you're like, I'm going to
might
wait.
It's gold to you, might not be good to other people.
True.
That's one thing. Timing is another thing. And... self-control and maturity, and I think when it comes to like sitting on music.
Yeah.
Because there have been scenarios where like we've gone ahead and like teased a song and song. I know how many Davido snippets there are. I'd be like, will this song ever come out? And the timing was just not right. So, for example, Can't Feel My Face on this album, I think we recorded that song like 2022. Shizzy did not even like Can't Feel My Face. I remember how many arguments me and David had with Cheesy. I'd be like, no, let's do another song. Let's do this. And I'm like, guy, trust me, this song, I've envisioned this song in particular at festivals and people singing the chorus back because it's relatable to anybody in the world. I Can't Feel My Face is not Yoruba or English. It's not Yoruba or Igbo or Spanish. It's English that everybody understands and everybody can relate to because we've all been there. And I remember when the song came out, and she was like, Omo, people really like this song. And I was like, that's what I think. We cannot always impose what we think is best. And that's why there's teams, there's partnership and stuff like that. Like I said, Loverboy on the album was recorded for Timeless. There are songs that we recorded 6 months before. And I'm like, we know this one is entering for sure. And even the With You that we're talking about and everybody's shouting about, I have people that I play music to for their opinions. Nobody that I played that song to liked it. And I said to all of them, I was like, this song is going to be huge. And those people all, even just before the album came, I was like, oh, I mean, that Omale song, me, I don't really like it. I've been in clubs with those people of recent. And I said to them, I'm like, look at you. So it's never about personal taste. There's a reason why we have been relevant in this thing for so long. We're able to use the experience we have, the mistakes we've made, and to make decisions on music based off of these things. Trends that are happening now. Oh, is this BPM what is in vogue in the clubs, right? It's many things.
So I want to go to a very emotional moment that you and David had recently at your wedding. And it felt so genuine and so authentic for him to talk about, you know, all the hard moments you guys had. Did you know, number one, what was the image in your mind when that moment happened?
Me too, I cried now. We've had,
take a moment.
Obviously, like with music, there have been like, with everybody's career, there's good, there's bad, there's been very bad, there's been very good. And I say to people all the time that there are very few people in my life that I can say have never switched up on me. And David is one of them. So obviously he got married the year before the celebration. I got married. We're all growing up. Things are changing. So it's just like, and it's not like it's tears of sorrow. Like it's tears of joy because like, wow, we never thought we'd get here. He says all the time in interviews, when we started working, all he wanted was for his video to be on MTV. And you know how I said to you guys that there is a point where you conquer something and you're like, okay, what's next now? the same way. I remember there was a time in like 2017 or 2018 where I don't know what caused it, but me and David walked around MSG and we're talking about like, we want to do a show here one day. I can't remember what took us. I think we did like an interview close to the band. We were just walking around the block or something. So to be able to like play venues like that, there are always going to be those pinch me moments and be like, oh, more. I remember when we were looking for a marketer to market our first album, or how I remember the first time we even did the O2. At that point in time, no Afrobeats artists had done like a headline show of their own. Mm-hmm. Live Nation and them lot were like, do we think we can put an Afrobeats artist in this space on his own to do a show? And these are like risks that you take, because at the end of the day, if it goes wrong, it's on your record for life. Mm-hmm. So being able to make all these sacrifices, make all these gambles, and still not compromise the values that we have always like stood by is a big deal. Like, as much as people will come and say, oh, this guy is too accessible, this guy does too many features, I see people all the time. There's times when I remember, for example, Olakira Maserati. I think David heard that song because we were in LA for something and I had just discovered the song, and I travel with speaker everywhere I go to. So in my room, I was playing it, and I think I had that song on repeat for a while. David has gone and DM'd this guy, send me the song. And like 3 days later, David is playing me a verse. Mm-hmm. That, oh, I did a remix to this song. Not because he was like, this song is so hot, I want to do. Whether David had done that remix or not done that remix, it's not going to change anything in David's career. David doesn't perform a song on his set today. Mm-hmm. But for example, with Data, I'll tell you, if we go to East Africa, we'll perform that song. Mm-hmm. That song is huge in East Africa. So there's David do the business, and there's still David Adeleke, the human being who just wants to help guys. Mm-hmm. And as much as he has been like chastising and they're like, oh, why do you do that? One thing David has made very clear to me is like, yes, I am going to listen to you on certain things, but at the end of the day, I'm still going to be me. If anyone has a problem with that, that's their own business. My story is completely different from other people's story. I am using the opportunity and the gift that I have, yes, to make money and to build my brand, but I'm going to carry other people on my back. I'm going to help people. If you have an issue with that, that's your own business. And part of what I was saying earlier on about me even making an effort to become more of a people's person and be friendlier and just be more social is from David. Mm. Because at the end of the day, with a guy who's this jovial, nice guy to everybody, you're going to be put in scenarios where you kind of have to be the same level. And it just makes life easier. Mm. So obviously that whole thing came from just experience after experience and just like, wow, this is what I'm finding here. Like, started working together when we were 19 and 17. Mm. Wait, sorry, I need to do the math. Back when came 2011. 20 and 18, sorry. No, actually, 17 and 19, because went since Christmas. I came back for Christmas. So 17 and 19. We are now 34 and 32. We have seen shege after shege after shege. Things that people would not survive. And this is what I keep saying to people about, like, solid friendships. Like, I know conversation people have had about me with David, but many people would be like, yeah, I don't want to work with that guy anymore. And I know conversations people have had with me about David. And what's real is real. You don't have, like, things like this, you don't have to formulate or pretend. And I still go back to the same thing. Me and this guy, we fight. Anybody who's close to us has witnessed us argue and have disagreements, but it's part of a healthy relationship. And also, just as men, we are just taught just be bad guys. And you can't survive being a bad guy 24/7. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. Everyone has downtime. Everyone needs a shoulder to cry on. Everybody needs people to support them. And like I was saying earlier on, like, I've been able to sieve out a few people that I know that, yeah, oh, you might not be the richest guy in the world, dude, but you're a guy who gives the best advice. You might not be the guy who gives the best advice, but you can solve my financial problems and you're willing to do it. You might not be the most fun guy to hang out with, but you keep me spiritually in check. Like, I have friends for different things. Mm-hmm. For example, I have an accountability group with my best friend, Larry, one of my other guys, who's, because we're all Catholic, where we talk about like, oh, when last did you go to mass? And it's not a thing like, might not, even us as we might not be as accountable as we used to be when we opened the group, but like we know it exists. Mm-hmm. And we know, like, for example, I try to go to mass every Wednesday, not because there's some rule in the Ten Commandments that I have to, but I know because the nature of my job, there's sometimes where like on Sundays, I'm just mad tired and I'm on a flight. So I'm like, guy, me and my relationship with God, I know how I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. Anyone who knows me to a certain level knows that I'm old school. The kind of values I have, certain things that people do now, I was like, dude, you did all of this just to be trending on Instagram. This is absurd to me. Like, it's how the craziest one to me is how, like, for example, people screenshot like personal conversation. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's just the way I'm built or like I'm just from a different cloth. It's absurd to me, mm-hmm. but everybody does their own thing, their own way. That's mm-hmm. just who I am. Mm-hmm. So everyone mm-hmm. do their own thing. Like, it's as you got this kind of person I am. I've been opportune and blessed to have certain people around me who have helped me develop as a person and just make me better and protect me. And I'll take you for that. Mm. The same way I always say to people, like, anybody who knows me knows that to enter my life comes with people. Mm. They know, everybody knows that I don't mess around with my siblings. Everybody knows. And for example, it's one thing I say to people, I'm like, you're not really my friend or you're not really my guy if you don't have a relationship with my brother and sister. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that taking my brother and sister on, there's a group of cousins I have that are basically my siblings too. For us to be of a certain, not as it's a do or die thing, but I just operate that way, like they are going to be in my business one way or the other here or there. It's just the way we've grown up and just the way we've been. And I think it's something me and David have in common because contrary to people saying, oh, this person is David's sister, this person is David's brother, they might be his cousins too. They all grew up that way together. I didn't grow up with a lot of my cousins around me. But as I grew up, I connected with certain cousins and those are my people. Mm-hmm. And I think the way I was brought up or the way me and my siblings grew up together, those are the most important people. Like, obviously, it's different now. I have a wife. It's my wife and my siblings. Everybody knows that about me. If you have a problem with any of those people, you have a problem with me. Mm-hmm. I'm not asking them questions to the problem. I'm first like, oh yeah, what's the issue? That's just how I've been.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'm ever going to change.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, you just got married. Yeah. And I'm curious, you know, how has that changed your life? Obviously, she owns a business too. I was her client many, many years ago. Yeah. So I'm curious how that's intertwined.
Her business is my business now. The meeting we're coming from here was about her business. Mm. I still got to go see someone that I think could help her business. Not even from like, just from an advice scenario. Because obviously with my business, I meet a lot of people. And I was like, yo, you should speak to this lady. She's been very successful in this part of the business. She could give you, because obviously like she's trying to expand her business. I'm like, this is someone I know who has done this successfully. Going back to what I said about it, there's no longer I. It's not like we, us. Her problem is my problem. My problem is her problem. I've always been a unit, collective kind of guy. So that's something that wasn't hard for me to slip into. And she's the same with me, like, in terms of, like, for example, her siblings. I remember when we first started dating, one of the most important things was us getting along with each other's siblings. Mm. At one point, we were even worried that our siblings might not even get along. And when we realized they were getting along, so we were like, wow, thank God. So for me, it's like, it's a decision you make and it's a decision you live with. It's a decision I've made and I'm ready to live with. So I wake up every day like it's just another day. Yeah. Mm.
Issa, so you went from being one of the youngest in the industry, right? And now we're basically called, either they call us OGs or unks or whatever level we are, right? How have you navigated that transition from, yo, guys, we were just 19 yesterday to now we're in our 30s? What sort of advice do you find yourself consistently giving to the ones up and coming in general, whether it's artists or managers or whoever?
I think my biggest piece of advice is always things like, don't make the mistakes we made. Mm. Perfect example of don't make the mistakes we made was, we all know for a fact, Latin music, for example. Mm. Latin music is very big because of the fact that Bad Bunny, J Balvin, Nicky Jam, they're all collaborating. That's a mistake we made. If David O, Wizkid, and everybody who was popping at that point, we were all collaborating, I might be wrong, but the probability of our genre even being bigger and more successful, or even like little things like ticket value at shows being stronger would be a thing. So is all those things like, don't let social media creates a lot of problems. One thing. So for me, it's a thing of like advice, like don't get sucked into this world where you're no longer realistic about what is real and what is fake. Obviously, ask questions. Like one thing I'm very keen on, I'm very proud of, is that they will tell you, you can call me right now, you can call Sam Frank now, Anthony. Guy, how did you do this? Where did you get this? I have no shame in doing that. Like, acquiring knowledge to me never stops. So for me, it's just that, like, educating people and just advising them based on the experience that I have attained over the years. And also finding a way to still maintain the young boy. I'm not that old.
But how do you, because we talked about how sometimes you pray for something, you desire something, you get there, right?
Yeah.
And then the question then is, what's next? And maybe you even get what's next and then, okay, what's next?
Yeah.
How have you, or what advice would you have for artists, managers, people who are even aspiring to become the greatest at what they do, but when they get there, it no longer bangs and they need to now reinvent themselves. And sometimes I've seen in the industry where somebody's so used to being relevant and then maybe the time has switched and it's time for a new crop of people. What advice do you have for people to be grounded and navigating that to the next transition?
You know, you're praying for blessings from God. Mm. You can't tell God, you can ask God for blessings, but you can't tell God to give you the blessing. You're not going to make God give you the blessing you want. God is going to give you what he thinks is best for you. Okay, look, for example, people might argue Davido did not have a classic album till Timeless. I choose to argue differently. I think A Good Time is a classic album. Mm-hmm. An album that has If Fall, Risky, and Blow My Mind on it, and Assurance is a classic. Mm-hmm. People would argue otherwise. Something that we've always wanted, okay, let us properly be in this classic conversation. It came, how many years later? It came 12 years later. Mm-hmm. And it came through in a big way. It got 3 Grammy nominations. We had an amazing tour. But the album has come out and we're like, what's next? So it's always, and that's the thing, especially about life in general, about being prepared. Your blessing can come in the form of anything. Your blessing could come in your partner. Mm. Your blessing could come in marriage. Your blessing could come in the business partner you choose to expand your business with. Your blessing could come with the producer you choose to work with. Mm. There are artists who have like stuck with one producer their whole career, and that person has been their blessing directly or indirectly. So for me, it's just about staying prepared, research, knowing that things change, knowing that there is the possibility that what you think is the right path might not be the right path, and being ready to accept that this is the path God has created for you. And then also with being a superstar for 10 years, and then obviously everything in life, there's always that come down. It's about knowing that day will come and being prepared for it. Because, for example, you go from being an artist who has an amazing run every year, a big album every 2 years, and then you go to a scenario where you're releasing a song every 2-3 years. Not because you don't have the music, but you're knowing that you're no longer as in demand. Because one of the mistakes a lot of people make is they continue releasing music like they are the A-list artists they were 5 years ago, and then there's so many misses that it's affecting your legacy. Mm-hmm. So it's about, and I was talking about like honesty, surrounding yourself with the right people to be able to be like, oh yeah, guys, we've reached that stage where it's time for a subtle decline, and we do it in a certain way so it doesn't come across like, ah, this guy dropped 20 songs and only one blue.
Yeah.
That is diminishing the story you've created for yourself. Yeah. So being able to do all these things, that's why like we were talking about data, knowing that, if I was getting 1 million views in 24 hours on YouTube before, I'm not getting 600K. Do I need to make a change, or is it just that time? Mm-hmm. Just being able to have those tough conversations with yourself and your team and everyone around you is very important.
Definitely. So we're going to our rapid fire segment, which is where we ask like quick questions. You give quick answers to the first thought that pops into your head. Okay. So what's one ritual you do before a big event or show that people would never guess?
Day of shows, I like to go to shows early by myself and just walk around the venue. Like most times, I don't think I really like arrive at venues. Once in a while, it does happen for different reasons, but I don't really arrive at venues like with David, for example. Mm. I'd have gotten to the venue and walk. I like walking in general, but I just like taking it in and then like, okay, we're here. That kind of thing. This is what we're doing today. This is the challenge of the day. That's one thing I like doing.
Okay. If you could manage any artist from history for a day, who would that artist be?
OG Kanye West.
OG.
OG Kanye West.
OG Kanye West.
Best three album Kanye West.
Okay. What's the strangest request you've ever seen in a writer?
That I've seen that I've not heard of.
Yeah. Or heard of.
Heard of? I can't remember what it is again. There was something in Mariah Carey's rider back in the day. I can't remember what it was, but that comes to mind. Purple Skittles. Has to be only the Purple Skittles.
Okay.
Yeah, that one. I actually know the person. It's not a Nigerian artist. Before blogs come and start saying, video request for Purple. Yeah.
What's your favorite venue to play at?
Brixton Academy.
Awesome. Why?
I think the energy in that room is amazing. It's not the biggest venue, but it's also a venue I grew up going to shows at. So I've been like a fan and I've been to shows when I'm working at them and the energy has always been the same.
Awesome. What's your favorite Nigerian food?
Favorite Nigerian?
Food.
I'm not a food guy. It'll be probably egusi or jollof rice.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, when you say you're not a food guy, you're a snack person instead?
I eat, but like, I'm one of those guys that, I want, like, I have my cravings here and yeah. there, but like, if you say, this is what we have in the fridge or this is what we're cooking, I'll eat and keep him pushing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Who's the most unexpected person in your contact?
I don't know, because with my growth, I mean, like, my trajectory, like, it's expected that certain people would be in my phone book. So, who would be the most unexpected person in my phone book as of today that, to me, is still like, wow.
Can you hit up Jay-Z?
I can get to him. I have everyone's phone number around here. Yeah. Tai, Bihi. Yeah. I have all their phone numbers. I'm trying to think. Also, the thing is, I think because of the way I grew up around superstars, I say to people all the time, there's only one person that I haven't met that I think I might have a little starstruck moment for. Three Stacks. I love Andre 2000. Yeah. That's the one person I haven't met.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, it would probably be something sports. But I also work in sports, so I have met a lot. Like, and for me, like when I say sports and like footballers, I'm not talking about footballers on the pitch today.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember when we did the Qatar World Cup, the draw. So obviously they had like the older players doing the draw. So Roberto Carlos, Didier Deschamps. And David was like, wow, I've not seen you successful before. I was like, dude, these are the guys I grew up watching football on. So that was a big deal to me. So I'm still trying to like wrap my head around like who on my phone book. Obviously I grew up being like a big Rockefeller fan. So maybe I would say, I never thought I'd have like Bihi's number or Tai's number or presidents of labels. Like obviously like Warner. So all these guys, and obviously now it's one call away. Like I can pick up the phone and call Peter Edge. I never thought I'd be able to do that. I don't know, man. Like, because to me, like it's normal now. Like I can pick up my phone and reach Chris Brown. I can pick up my phone and call Timbaland. But like, it's like, because obviously over the course of time, it's become regular to me. But I'm thinking like, who is in my phone book that, I mean, like there's JJ Okocha, who's like my favorite footballer of all time. Yeah. But with him is, I was familiar. We knew each other before even David's success. Obviously Nigeria can be a small place. And obviously like, me and him share the same birthday. So, and I'm really cool with his wife also and stuff. I used to actually promote at number 10 when I was much younger. So that's how I'm cool with them. I'll probably say it's probably be like leaders of countries. Like I have access to be able to call some top shotters.
Yeah.
Some people that even my uncles and aunties are like, wow, you have access to these people. But I tell people all the time, I'm like, I see music as an avenue to do so much more.
Yeah.
So music will get you into certain rooms, but it's not about like, what can you do with those, with the access to those people?
What did it feel like when you guys first sold out the O2 or the biggest venue you guys have ever sold out? But not, O2 is not the biggest venue, but what did it feel like for that O2 specific moment where it's like, wow.
Disclaimer, you do realize that the O2 is actually one of the biggest arenas. So the O2 is still a big deal, but yeah. Nigerians have Nigerianized this. I would say the first O2, I remember, so you know one thing that is done with arenas is that when you're selling tickets for an arena, you open up in stages. So I think when we opened up the O2, tickets were, I think it was like 8K first, then we got to 12K. And then when we got to 12K, I remember the promoters and our agents and everybody were like, I think we should stop it here so we don't open up more. And we were like, why? Let's continue going. I remember sitting in, at that point in time, our agents were William Morris, sitting in the office in London being like, no, let's open it up more. We can sell these tickets. And us, and this is why, like, we have those emotional moments. Cause like, I remember when we were arguing that we can do this and people were like, we don't think you can. So getting to that stage where like you hit 14K tickets, hit 16K tickets, those that, and the challenges and people not believing in you and not being thinking that you can't do this. So people doing multiple dates at the O2 or coming back and doing it again. Cause I think we've done the O2 three times now, three or four times. And so the first O2 will always be like, have a special place in my brain. It will always be a core memory. I remember being in the crowd when David was going up on the stage with, for the IA intro. I've been like, wow. Or even like challenges that day of like going over time and the venue being like, yo, this is curfew. If you go over this time, and then this guy is performing, not knowing that all these catastrophes are happening backstage, or me talking in his ears through the mic saying like, yo, we need to rush through the next five songs because they've extended the curfew to this time. So definitely the first O2 core memory. First time David played Brixton Academy will always be a core memory for me because that was like the icing on the cake of that If and Fall run. It's a venue that I've been to a million times. Doing Wireless was a big deal to me because I've been to Wireless as a fan. Playing Madison Square Garden, performing at the World Cup because I'm a huge football fan will always be, I think even if I have 25 children, top 10 moments, performing at the World Cup will still be there.
Yeah.
Core memory would always be getting nominated for a Grammy the first time. I remember David was not even watching his, and then I called him and I was like, yo. And I remember just like putting my finger up and going three. My friend was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, you got three nominations. That being a core memory. Love My City doing the numbers it did and the whole process behind it and like, seeing this person going from being like a Nigerian superstar to turning to a global superstar, core memory for me. I think I've said most of them.
Yeah. You have more to me.
More coming. More,
yeah.
I think the other question, or my last question before we close, when we look back now, and not necessarily from now, but even in 10 years from now, 20 years from now, right? I've been reflecting on how sometimes social media makes it seem like there's all this like, Whisket FC, Davido FC, Burner FC. Do you sometimes think that the, I mean, you already mentioned it, but do you think it was a missed opportunity in the sense of, man, this thing starting like, at least this current group was 08, 09, 10. Nobody could have dreamed at the rooms you people have walked into, the places you guys have been. Do you sometimes feel like there's a missed opportunity in the sense of,
course,
now that we're all here in this moment to celebrate and really to honor each other in that way?
Of course.
Yeah.
I totally agree. I say it all the time. I'm not going to sit here because I'm a member of One Factor and everything and be like, I think, yes, there's a missed opportunity. I think the whole thing is one of the dumbest things that's ever been done. I say it all the time. And I, like I keep saying, Latin music, perfect example. All the big people are friends. And that's the thing about it. We don't have to be friends. This is a business. And that's what it is like. I'm very territorial about people around me. Like, I like to surround myself around people I get along with and have a mutual respect for. But at the end of the day, business is business. If we have a duty to get Afrobeats to a certain level.
Yeah.
And I just feel like it's one of the boxes we didn't tick.
So my last question that we ask every single guest is, who do you want to see on this side on the Afropolitan podcast? Whose story needs to be fully told?
He had Uncle Obi already.
Yes.
You know me, I'm a fan of like the back end people. Sunday Array.
Sunday Array.
That's a good one.
Him. Yeah. Him or... You know, the thing is that when we were growing up, like us, the role of like a manager was not what it was today. So it's not as if like we grew up with like role models per se. But someone who's been able to stay relevant from that time, whether it's by being a booking agent or a manager, I would say from that group of people that I personally mess with and like and who has been a good person to me, I'd say Sunday.
Okay.
Sunday. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, man.
This was great.
This was amazing.